For more than 20 years, Roy Reed was a newspaper reporter for the Arkansas Gazette and then the New York Times. He was hired by the Times to cover the southern United States and reported on the civil rights movement, hurricanes, and politics. Later, he reported from the White House, the presidential campaign trail, and from London as the Times correspondent there. His new book, Beware of Limbo Dancers, A Correspondent's Adventures with the New York Times, is a memoir of his days with the Times, but also the Gazette, and a bit about his childhood and adolescence in Hot Springs and the Ouachita Mountains. Roy now lives in Hawkeye, and last week he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about the book published by the University of Arkansas Press. He writes in Beware of Limbo Dancers that he was not quite the Southerner that Northerners imagined.
I was a hill fellow, not a delta fellow in broad terms. I couldn't really speak the language. Well, you hear what I sound like. I sound more like maybe Lyndon Johnson than, Senator, what's his name, from Mississippi or Alabama. And I write a little bit about the difference in the language from the upland South and the deep South, and have a little fun with that. But I was, I did not grow up in anything like a plantation society. And I think that's probably, or in those days at least, back in the 60s, that was the national image of a Southerner, a white Southerner especially. Somebody from Georgia maybe, Louisiana maybe. Mm-hmm. And those of us up on the fringe, western northern Arkansas, I grew up in Hot Springs, we didn't fit that image. And I think that's what I wanted to make clear.
When you were first with the Times and you're traveling about, you mentioned that you discovered this in your previous days with the Gazette, that a reporter's day starts slowly, then builds to a crescendo around deadline.
Oh, yes. You know that feeling. And there's nothing quite like the rush. And sometimes you feel good about it, and sometimes you just want to pull your hair out. The worst days or when you have too much to do in too short a time, and you learn to just hammer it out. We had two or three guys at the Gazette, and they were all guys in this general assignment category, who could just write as fast as they could think. I mean, and incredible typists, like 90 words a minute, something like that, on these old Underwood typewriters. I was never built for that, for speed of any kind, to tell the truth. And that's the worst, when you have too many stories to get in before the deadline, which is usually about 6:30 or 7. And the second worst thing is being stuck for a lead on a story, the first paragraph or two or three. And those of us who struggle over our writing anyway always found that finding the right lead was the hardest part. And I've known other reporters who would write a lead, rip it out of the typewriter, throw it in the wastebasket, write another, and ended up with half a dozen leads thrown away before they found one that suited them. But, yeah, it all comes to a head just before deadline. And then when the deadline passes and you can relax, I suspect that period of time before and after the deadline accounts for a lot of the hard drinking that used to happen in newspapers. There's a line in one of Kris Kristofferson's songs that goes like, whether it's the going up is worth the coming down. And you wonder about that. But coming down is an important part of it, and you have to learn how to handle the coming down just as you have to learn the going up before the deadline.
And I guess when there are many of you coming down together, alcohol could even be easier.
Oh, yeah.
Because you've
yeah.
got this sort of
yeah, it is
camaraderie.
And the single guys would all just head en masse to a particular bar that they all favored. In Little Rock, there were two or three favorite bars over the years. We married fellas almost never went with them. Or if any of the married guys did, they were usually in trouble at home.
Not a good gang to hang out with.
No, not a good gang to hang out. But we managed it, and it's hard on marriages, newspaper work is, or used to be. I guess it still is. And that's just one of the reasons. The reporter gets home, and he's still kind of strung up and needing to do something to get past that. And if there's anything, any piddling thing going on with your wife or your kids, or your nowadays with your husband and your kids, then you're likely to blow a fuse instead of handling it calmly. So it's and that's one reason that reporters often burn out. It's very unusual for reporters to last until old age in the trade. I've known only two or three of all the years I spent in newspapering. And I never quite figured out what kept those people going. In one case, I can be pretty certain it was anger. Old Morton Mintz of the Washington Post woke up mad every day and went to bed mad over some outrage that some bureaucrat had done or some corporation had pulled. And that kept him going. But that's kind of rare. Most reporters end up doing either some less demanding part of newspapering. They become an editor, a copy editor, or this, that. Or they just shuck it all and get into public relations or, in my case, teaching.
Right. Well, when you were with the Gazette, you would file your stories, type them up, I would imagine, generally in a newsroom. When you were the Southern correspondent or the White House correspondent for the Times, you would have been filing away from an office. In the 1960s, how did you – if you're in Selma, how did you file a story to meet deadline?
That was one of the very hardest parts of the thing, and purely logistical. Nowadays, there are all kinds of ways to file. You carry a laptop that's plugged into this, that, the other back, and you just write your story and push a button, and it goes off into the ether, and the next step is some editor grabs it and starts editing. But back then, you had to find a telephone. Sometimes that was easy. At Selma, for example, I had a room at the Albert Hotel, and it had a telephone. And if I had time, and usually I did, I could scamper back to the hotel a few blocks away and just to pick up the phone and get the recording room on 43rd Street in New York and speak the story, you know, talk it slowly. That could be a lot of fun sometimes. These are New Yorkers at the other end, and I was not a New Yorker. But that was the logistics of the thing. Now, the hard ones are you're away from any population center. There are no telephones nearby. Or you may be in a town, but you're having to rely on a payphone at a phone booth. And all the other reporters who might be with you are scrambling for the same phones. There used to be some kind of famous stories about reporters literally coming to blows for the telephone. The old UPI guy who beat the AP correspondent to the story when John Kennedy was killed. He literally took the phone away from him in the press car following the motorcade. And the AP guy was beating him on the back and the head, trying to get him to
– Literally beating him.
Literally beating him. And Smith wouldn't give it up. But that's pretty rare. But mainly just struggling to find a phone. One time I was covering Hurricane Camille, and there were no phones within 50 miles of the Gulf Coast where it hit the hardest. And I had to drive north first to get – because the roads were blocked going east to west. I had to drive north in Mississippi to Hattiesburg, which is about close to 100 miles from the coast, and then back south to the coast with very little time to do any reporting on the scene, and then head back up the road to find a working telephone. That might have been the worst experience I had, but it was a problem.
So you wouldn't, in an extreme situation like that, I'm imagining you did not have time to sit down at a typewriter and type, you would have to just dictate from your notes on the phone?
Good question. The old wire service reporters could do it off the top of their head. And in fact, some of the most amazing performances I've ever seen were on the White House beat much later, where they would have to literally run from the press room back to the one end of the White House to the other to get to their telephones. And they would grab their phone, which would be an open line, and just start talking into the phone. Leads perfectly formed in their heads. I never understood how to do that. I always had to at least write out with a pencil and pad the first paragraph or two. And then now and then, I didn't have time to compose the whole thing but on a typewriter. I had to just talk it. And that's a separate skill, one that reporters, I suspect, don't have to learn these days.
Well, of course, in radio, and just about everyone who reports now can record something. And you write of a time when you were covering a eulogy that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave. And you said it was one of the most eloquent things you've ever heard. But you and other reporters, because no one was recording, you had to get together and say, is this what we heard? You wanted to get every word right.
That's right. And we settled on what we thought was our best reckoning on what he had actually his exact words. And, of course, years later, all reporters were carrying recorders, and some of them pretty bulky machines. But back then, we were on our own.
Roy Reed is the author of the new book, Beware of Limbo Dancers, A Correspondent's Adventures with the New York Times. We'll hear more from the conversation in just a moment, including his reporting on the day police lobbed tear gas at civil rights marchers at the Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. That's in just a moment on this edition of Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. We continue with our conversation with Roy Reed, author of Beware of Limbo Dancers, A Correspondent's Adventures with the New York Times, published by the University of Arkansas Press. Roy spent more than 20 years as a newspaper reporting, including years covering the southern United States for the New York Times. He was one of the reporters at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, on Bloody Sunday, March 7, 1965, when Alabama State troopers, armed with billy clubs and tear gas, attacked civil rights marchers. When you were covering something that was happening right there in front of your eyes, I'm thinking about the incident at the Pettus Bridge with the march where tear gas is lobbed at civil rights marchers, and there is this wedge of billy club wielding law enforcement officers beating people. How do you get that into a lead paragraph and a newspaper article?
Would you like for me to read that?
That would be wonderful.
If you can find it.
Let's see.
While you're looking for that, I might throw in that the tear gas there choked up television people, reporters, newspaper reporters, the marchers, everybody except the law enforcement people who had gas masks. And if you've ever breathed tear gas, I don't have to describe what it's like. It's very nearly unbearable.
Well, when you described it in the book, what really hit home was you were talking about how you couldn't breathe, your eyes are tearing, but the worst part is then realizing you're completely vulnerable to whatever comes next.
Absolutely, yeah. You can't see and you can't breathe. Yeah, there you're just standing at target. And that was just the reporters.
Yeah, who did not take the brunt of
that. That's right. The people who really suffered were the marchers. But you ask, how do you come up with a lead? Well, this is what I came up with on not in the lead, but just a few paragraphs down where I felt I had to describe what it looked like and felt like and tasted like. It went like this. The wedge, that was a wedge of state troopers and sheriff's people on horseback with horse whips and billy clubs. The wedge moved with such force that it seemed almost to pass over the waiting column instead of through it. The first 10 or 20 Negroes were swept to the ground screaming, arms and legs flying, and packs and bags went skittering across the grassy divider strip and onto the pavement on both sides. Those still on their feet retreated. A cheer went up from the white spectators lining the south side of the highway. Then came the pop of a tear gas canister, and a venomous cloud covered the highway. Through the mist, I heard coughing, the sound of clubs on flesh and bone, and cries of pain. The men on horses sped through the fleeing marchers, wielding whips on faces, backs, and legs. The spectators whooped and cheered. And then I add on my own in the book, I hope never again to see such hatred in the eyes of men, women, and, yes, children.
When you write about that incident, and it's in the New York Times, I'm imagining when you're dictating that or getting that into the paper, you're not thinking about the fact that so many – or maybe you are. So many people are going to see this, and I guess you are. The responsibility you have as a reporter to tell people exactly what happened. Although there were television stations, and this is very famous video now, but the responsibility to get it right.
Well, yeah, and especially in if you're working for one of the big national papers, the Times, the Washington Post, the L.A. Times, the Christian Science Monitor in those days, the Wall Street Journal, we all felt that responsibility. I should say that in the case of that incident at Selma, Alabama, on March the 7th, 1965. I would like to take credit for helping to arouse the nation's anger and conscience, but the truth is it was the television broadcasts that did it. Beginning on the evening newscasts that night and the next day, over and over, they showed this horrible scene that had unfolded there in an American city, against American citizens, and it was revolting. And the typical response of people who saw that on television was, this is terrible. Why do we put up with this? And enough of those angry citizens let their public officials know how they felt, that the immediate result of that incident was to lead in a matter of weeks to the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And you could trace it in a direct line. There was no doubt at all what had sparked that national revulsion that caused that voting, and we're still using that Voting Rights Act today.
When it's a big story about like civil rights issue, and you saw trial after trial where people who it was somewhat obvious had beaten or murdered people and would be acquitted. And you saw also a quick progress in advancement when the Voting Rights Act was passed. Did you ever have to battle cynicism?
No. Oddly enough, I never did feel cynical. I felt a lot of anger, occasionally sadness, anger most often at the miscarriages of justice in particular. I think first of all of a case I actually wrote about in the book, a fellow named Tom Coleman, a leading citizen of Lowndes County, Alabama, worked for the county government. And when I say a leading citizen, I mean an old family, as they like to say in Alabama. Family went back generations on the land there. His Sky's sister was, I think, the school superintendent. And he one day just casually walked up to a grocery store that had a front porch And when what they called an outside agitator walked out on the porch, a white fellow, a minister, Coleman just raised his shotgun and shot him dead. And he was brought to trial. You know, they went through the formality of an arrest, and it meant nothing because he was never convicted, and everybody in that little old town knew that he had never be convicted. All of Alabama understood that, that was just an accepted way of doing business. There were enforcers in a lot of these little old towns who were they considered it a kind of civic duty to keep the black folks down, to keep them in their place, to uphold white supremacy, the age-old way that things had been done. And I don't think any of them were ever convicted of crime. As I say, it was considered a kind of civic duty.
And you call it the newest lost cause,
this sort
of white supremacy that was existing.
That's right, yeah.
You write, sometimes when you're looking back at some of your writing, you say that you smarted off in your writing.
Probably did.
You, and using your term, smarted off, there's one time in Beware of Limbo Dancers that you still get a new smarting off. You talk about one of these people who was eventually convicted of murder decades later and sentenced to 80 years in jail. And you write, he will be 140 when he's released, barring health complications.
Yes, I admit it. I enjoyed writing that line.
Roy, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Roy Reed's new book is Beware of Limbo Dancers, A Correspondent's Adventures with the New York Times, published by the University of Arkansas Press. He'll discuss the book tomorrow night at Giffel's Auditorium in Old Main on the University of Arkansas campus as part of a celebration of faculty authors. That event begins tomorrow night at 7. He'll also speak at the U of A Global Campus just off the Fayetteville Square Thursday afternoon at 2 in conjunction with the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. And he'll speak at the Fayetteville Public Library November 15th. You can also hear more from our conversation in an audio extra at ozarksatlarge.com, including what he thinks the future holds for newspapers and journalism.
But the need for information, it will never go away. Mm-hmm. And information has value. It has monetary value. And there will always be people who are willing to pay money. Pay for reliable information with the emphasis on reliable.
That audio extra can be heard at ozarksatlarge.com. ¶¶